WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're unpacking the forum we put on earlier this month with WECT and Port City Daily, featuring candidates running for state office. As in past years, we structured this forum around questions from our newsrooms, from listeners, viewers, and readers, and from audience members who attended the event. WHQR's questions in particular were based around our community agenda, which surveyed hundreds of community members from a diverse cross-section of backgrounds and political views. You can find more about our community agenda project in the show notes. We had four state senate candidates for District 7, which covers most of New Hanover County except for a carve-out in downtown and central Wilmington. We had Libertarian candidate John Evans, that's John with an H, not to be confused with our MC, WECT anchor John Evans. We also had Republican incumbent Michael Lee and Democratic challenger Dr. David Hill. We also had Catherine Katie Randall, the Democratic challenger in District 8, which covers Brunswick, Columbus, and that carve-out in Wilmington. Republican incumbent Bill Raven did not respond to requests to appear. For the House seats, we had District 17 covering Leland and Central Brunswick County. Democratic challenger Charles Jones is running against Republican incumbent Frank Eiler. In District 19, covering Southern New Hanover County, Pleasure Island, and Coastal Brunswick County, we had Democratic challenger Jill Brown. Republican incumbent Charlie Miller did not attend, saying he was volunteering in Western North Carolina. And in District 20, covering central New Hanover County and Wrightsville Beach, we had Republican incumbent Ted Davis and Democratic challenger John Berger. You can find more about the candidates at WHQR.org, and while you're there, you can watch the entire forum, which we encourage you to do. But now, to help us unpack the highlights from the forum, my colleague Nikolai Mather is here. Nikolai, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Okay, so right off the bat, we got into education funding, one of the questions we hear about a lot. We asked this question for all of our House and Senate candidates. The question was basically how people felt about public school education in general, and specifically about the Opportunity Scholarship Program, the private school voucher program. Now, this program has been very controversial. It takes public money and allows families to spend that on charter or private schools. Proponents of the bill say it gives families, and especially those in low-income brackets, more opportunities to pursue education outside of their zip code. But critics have noted that the research doesn't show academic improvement and that most of the vouchers used in programs around the country were for kids who were never in the public school system in the first place. And that research also shows that while you get some improvement from voucher-inspired competition from between public schools and private schools, that the best way to improve public schools is just to fund them directly. And there's some other concerns as well, which we'll hear from some of our candidates. So we'll start here with our Libertarian candidate for State Senate District 7, John with an H. Evans.
We need to make sure that everyone, regardless of their parents' wealth, gets an equal educational opportunity.
So Evans was pretty adamant about conserving school funding for public schools specifically. He talked at length about his experiences as someone who grew up with public schools. I believe he mentioned also, Ben, that he was a school teacher at one point, right?
He did, indeed. Although, as with many of his answers, I have to say he didn't really get into policy specifics. So as he said, you know, every child deserves equal educational opportunities. That's in the state constitution. But he didn't come down hard one way or the other on the actual voucher program. Staying in State Senate District 7, here's Democratic challenger David Hill.
The most recent act for these scholarships was to take more than $240 million more dollars just to ensure that the wealthiest families in the state could get a little help with the private school tuition they're already paying. The vouchers in most cases do not cover the entire cost of private school tuition. That starts in the teens of thousands of dollars in most places, and I know schools that run well over $20,000 or $30,000. So this is not doing it. On the other hand, that same money given to public schools would make a huge difference. These schools do not, some of them may offer special needs, but most of them do not cover kids with special needs. They're looking for the kids with the highest test scores who are going to get into the best colleges.
So Hill here is getting at both the accountability issue for private schools, which don't have to answer to the same laws that public schools do, and also the question of whether or not this financial incentive is really meaningful for a family that doesn't have $20,000, even the lowest income family getting, you know, somewhere around $7,500. Is that actually a meaningful way to close that financial gap? A lot of people we've talked to have said no. So moving on, here's Democratic challenger Katie Randall, who's running for State Senate District 8.
We've seen the Republican-led legislature authorize hundreds of millions of dollars to go to those private school vouchers. A good chunk of that money is going to families that could already afford private school. And I'll add to that that it, and this is because I am running to represent Brunswick and Columbus counties, which are more rural than New Hanover. This disproportionately affects rural counties. You may have counties in this state that have a good number of private schools. That is not Brunswick. That is not Columbus. Frankly, it's not really New Hanover either, but Brunswick and Columbus, what's happening is that those tax dollars are now being diverted to other counties where students can maybe take advantage of that. But that is not an equal, a just, and sound education for every child in North Carolina.
So in addition to opposing the voucher program, Randall also spoke about the need to increase base salaries, particularly for teachers in the rural areas that she represents. And Nikolai, this is something you've heard.
So Randall kind of gets into a concern that has been expressed to me repeatedly by teachers and other people who work in education in the run-up to Election Day this year. The current teacher salary that is being offered by the General Assembly. Something that I've talked a lot about with officials in Pender County is how they are currently struggling with staff shortages because as a county with a lower tax base than, say, Brunswick County, they can't really offer much in the way of like supplemental pay for teachers. So if you're a teacher and if you're moving to southeastern North Carolina and you're looking for a place to get the best pay, you're not going to wind up in Pender County. You're going to wind up in Brunswick County. You're going to wind up in New Hanover County if you can find affordable housing. And as a result, that just kind of contributes to larger class sizes and more discipline issues and things of that nature. So that's really what she's trying to get at with this quote, it seems like. We'll move on now to Michael Lee, who talked a little bit about school funding as well.
You can't have choice unless you have money, and that's why the state is going to afford opportunity scholarships for families to go to other schools other than traditional privates. There's been so many misstatements here, it's just hard to use up my 90 seconds. Rich people, we just funded $248 million, David said, to fund rich people. You know, we funded 15,000 families that have an average of $115,000 annual income for four. I wouldn't consider that a rich family. Someone else said that all this money's been diverted. The entire Opportunity Scholarship, the whole bucket of money, is less than 4.5% of the K-12 education budget.
Lee was clearly frustrated about some of the ways that the voucher program was represented. It is true that this is money that the public schools would lose in either case. When a student leaves the public school system to go to a private school, that per-student funding evaporates. And he's pointed out that there is actually now a reinvestment fund, so schools actually can get a little bit of that money back because they would take the $9,000 that a student would get, subtract whatever the voucher amount is, and the rest can go back into public education. He also pushed back against the representation of this program as being kind of a handout for the rich. There are several tiers. The first one goes up to around $58,000. The next one goes up to around $115,000, then up to $260,000, and then over that. So when you say rich, I think that is a little bit subjective. The counterpoint here would be that these are families that probably could afford private school if they set their mind to it, if that was a priority for that family. The last point I'll say is that Lee is correct. This is only a small portion of the overall education budget, but we did a little back of the napkin math, and the amount of money that's going out every year through this program spread over the, let's say, 80 to 90,000 public school teachers in the state, that's around $2,000 to $3,000 a year, you know, as a stipend. So that's not nothing. So I just want to give you a sense of the stakes. As we stick with this issue and move to candidates running for House seats, up first, Democrat Jill Brown.
I absolutely disagree with the scholarship and the voucher program. I think that fleecing our public schools of public funds is fundamentally wrong, and it violates our Constitution. The Constitution of North Carolina guarantees that every child has an equal opportunity to a sound and quality education. So by giving money to private schools that are not regulated at the same standards that public education is regulated, is disenfranchising, again, I love the word disenfranchising, many communities, especially the rural communities, because they don't have access to those charter and specialized schools.
Disenfranchising was kind of Jill Brown's word of the night. She used that word repeatedly to describe the current state of public education in North Carolina and also the voucher program generally.
Yeah, and I will make a note, the Constitution of South Carolina is written differently than that of North Carolina, but for reference, in South Carolina, the Supreme Court actually blocked the voucher program in that state because it violated South Carolina's state constitution, basically saying this very thing, that giving public money to private schools was a violation of the way the state had intended to run its public education system.
Now we'll move on to current Representative Frank Eiler, who talked a little bit about school vouchers and touched a little bit on vaccine policy as well.
I'm for choice, not mandates in many cases, including vaccines. But there again, in education, 59% of the budget goes to education, of your state budget, 59% of a $30 billion budget. The money that's left when the funding goes to the other schools besides the traditional public schools. Charter schools are public schools, by the way. But the traditional public schools, they get to free themselves of a student, but keep some of the money for busing and food and so forth. There's a lot less money that goes to the other schools than is put into the public schools. That's something that we don't talk about a lot. Full choice, not mandates.
So although it was not the question, we've got Republican incumbent Frank Eiler from Brunswick County taking a swipe here at vaccine mandates. I don't know exactly what he's talking about, but I imagine it's probably those COVID-19 era regulations rolled out by Governor Cooper's office during the pandemic.
Yes.
And then moving on to talk about, there are funding streams that continue even after a student leaves, but really the lion's share of funding that goes into public schools is from the state. So that is what's at stake. Eiler is, at the end of the day, saying that he is in favor of the student vouchers and doesn't seem to have much concerns about them. And just a quick fact check, Eiler is correct. He is talking about the $30 billion budget. Basically, 58 to 59% of the budget does go to education. All right, moving right along, we've got Eiler's Democratic challenger, Charles Jones.
Taking funding away isn't fair to public schools. For private schools, it's just that, private. If one can afford private schools, that's fine. But at the same time, you should concentrate on the public schools because the vouchers is taking money out of the public funds for our public schools, and that isn't fair. To basically give Christian schools more funding for that, we should prioritize our public schools.
So just to push back a little bit on Charles Jones's quote here, like Eiler said, charter schools are not private schools. They're not necessarily Christian schools. They are public schools.
That is correct. Yeah, and there are plenty of non-denominational private schools, you know, just in the New Hanover County region that we see people going to.
Sure, absolutely. But Jones also, he, again, comes out very strongly in favor of public schools, saying that we should prioritize our public schools above all else, and is not in support of the voucher program. Moving on, we have John Berger, who also spoke a little bit about school vouchers.
Right now, what we're talking about is funneling hundreds of millions of dollars to people who can afford to send their kids to private school and already are sending their kids to private school. In fact, publicly known data shows that 55% of the people taking advantage of these vouchers are in the top two brackets, not the lower brackets. So in my mind, that's wrong. That's not helping the people that need to be helped.
So Democratic challenger John Berger, who's running against incumbent Republican Ted Davis, is pointing here to reporting that shows that the majority of families in the queue for these opportunity scholarships were in the upper tiers of the program, so making over $115,000 a year. So some proponents of the school voucher program has framed this as basically being a way to help low-income families get better education by going to a charter school or a private school, but that doesn't seem to be who's actually applying for those vouchers.
Moving on now, we'll go to Ted Davis.
I support opportunity scholarships because one size does not fit all. One thing that's been said here that is incorrect, money is not taken away from public schools for the opportunity scholarships. They come from two entirely funding mechanisms within the budget. One does not take away from the other, and that's something that's being said that's very much misinformation. The other thing people don't talk about is on the opportunity scholarships, It's on a sliding scale. What that means is the more money that a couple makes, the less money they're going to get for the Opportunity Scholarship. The reverse of that is the less money they make, the more money they will get. So it's not like the wealthier families are getting just as much as someone that might be in a lower income.
So Davis is correct. There is a separate funding mechanism for the Opportunity Scholarships. As far as the sliding scale, that is correct, but I think the issue here is that it's not a huge difference. $7,000, as several of the candidates pointed out, probably wouldn't get a low-income family under the $58,000 lowest bracket over the financial hill into a school where tuition could be $20,000 or $25,000 a year.
Absolutely. And the fact that there is a tier at all for those making over $259,000, they still get $3,360 per scholarship, which I think is interesting to note. It's still a chunk of money going towards people who, as past opponents to Davis have stated, could probably afford private schools if they put their minds to it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be hearing from the candidates on some environmental issues. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here with my colleague Nikolai Mather as we continue to unpack our forum for candidates running for state, House, and Senate positions.
Right now we're on the topic of environmental issues. So we're going to hear next from Ted Davis, who is running for House, about PFAS.
Yeah, this was kind of a complicated question. We were asking about the General Assembly's ability to give the Department of Environmental Quality kind of more power to regulate and then enforce those regulations when it comes to chemicals like PFAS, that's Gen X and other forever chemicals, and 1,4-dioxane, which is a lesser-known chemical but also a problem. So here's what Davis had to say on this issue.
So I went to the Speaker of the House and asked him if he could form a committee so that we could study this, so we could find out what it is that we were dealing with. And he said he would do that. It was the River Quality Committee, and I chaired that committee. I introduced the first bill to get funding for DEQ to address the pollution problem, and it passed the House, and it went over to the Senate. And it went into law, and that funding started. I voted for every bit of funding since then that will help us to address the PFAS problem. Also, I introduced a bill to limit the use of firefighting foam that has PFAS in it. Passed the House. It's over sitting in the Senate now. I also introduced to hold polluters responsible, such as Chemours, for the pollution they're putting in our waters, because what happens is the public utility systems in Brunswick County and New Hanover are having to foot the bill for this equipment that they're having to buy to get the pollution out of it. And that is wrong. Ratepayers should not have to pay for this. The people who pollute it should. And unfortunately, and I cannot believe this, but the biggest resistance I've gotten from that bill is from the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce and other business entities that see it as a hindrance for businesses to be here, and I don't.
This response was fascinating to me. I think I remember when he actually called out the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce, there was just a flurry of activity with the journalists in the corner. He actually called them the biggest obstacle to getting bills like this passed.
Notably, the North Carolina Manufacturers Alliance put a major stumbling block in the way of research that would have done an open-ended study of all of the chemicals that are in waterways. Instead, they did a much more limited study. And in the words of the Manufacturing Alliance, they wanted to prevent the state from, quote, opening Pandora's box. So more recently, we've seen pushback from the Chamber of Commerce, and we're surprised to see Davis call them out because he is actually a Chamber of Commerce endorsed candidate this year, and he's been very pro-business in the past. Also, just a fact check here, Davis is correct. He has filed a bill that would penalize companies like Chemours for the cost of filtering the water. Davis's bill, which he has tried for 2 years running to get past committee and in front of the governor, would actually put Chemours on the hook for that. It had a lot of bipartisan support. The city of Wilmington endorsed it. But again, the Chamber of Commerce has really stalled it. And I'll say, while Davis has some clout in the House, he just doesn't seem to be able to get enough political juice to get it over the finish line. I know there's been talk about trying it for a third year, but we'll have to wait and see on that.
Yes, we will. Next up is Charles Jones, who also talked a little bit about PFAS, specifically as it relates to Brunswick County.
Yes, I think more restrictions is needed. However, they want to relax the code to where big business can pollute our water system as well as our land and air.
Once in office, no, I don't think that's the opportunity to do so. So, yes, I would support strict situations on PFAS.
Pretty straightforward. Up next, we have Jill Brown, who actually had a very personal anecdote.
Funding to Department of Environmental Quality has been reduced over the past several years, rather than being increased when we hold the number one most PFAS-polluted water in the country is in the Cape Fear region. To add insult to injury of all of this, I was recently diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma, and my doctor said that we are a cluster for this kind of cancer here. And that is because our water is polluted. And it is a priority to get the situation cleaned up and force these companies that are dumping their toxins in our source water to pay to get it cleaned up. Because we owe that to our residents and our constituents.
So Jill Brown is far from the only person we've heard from who suspects that their cancer diagnosis or the cancer diagnosis for a loved one stems from their exposure to PFAS. It may be a long time before we can say definitively, legally, that PFAS are carcinogenic, but the evidence so far shows they are not good for you. And while there are some significant differences in opinion in how legislators think the state should regulate emerging contaminants, I've heard pretty bipartisan agreement, at least from southeastern North Carolina, that polluters like Chemours should be held financially accountable. Here is Frank Eiler on this issue.
Not only would I already have, Representative Davis and I just sponsored another bill to hold PFAS polluters liable, and that was House Bill 864. That bill is stalled, as they said, some of the powerful business people helped stall it, apparently. I don't know what happened there, but Representative Davis is the primary, and I'm the second primary on that bill. And it's still alive, and if it doesn't pass this session, it'll pass next session.
So we were definitely interested to hear a little bit about House Bill 864, and we're hoping to explore its future in future coverage. I do admire his optimism.
Again, this is the bill that would hold polluters like Chemours directly responsible for the cost of filtering out water. And so we're hearing from both Davis and Eiler that this was a pretty straightforward bill that got sidelined by powerful business interests. Very interested, as Nikolai said, to see where this bill goes, if it makes it to the Senate, if it makes it to the governor's desk. We don't even know at the moment we're recording this who will be that governor. So a lot more coverage on that issue. But now we're moving on to John Berger, also talking about PFAS pollution.
I want to actually commend Representative Davis for his polluter pays bill. I think that that's a good bill. The problem is they're in the supermajority and they can't get it done. So we have to think about that. Why is that? They're complaining about business entities are stopping it, installing it. Those are people that are friendly to the Republican Party. So I'm not really sure exactly what is preventing this bill from being passed, which actually would be a good bill for the citizens of New Hanover County and for the state of North Carolina.
I think this is an interesting open question, and there are internal politics in the General Assembly and even within the Democratic and Republican Party. I can say, years ago when Davis filed a bill early on in the Gen X saga, he was pretty publicly mocked by Senate Leader Phil Berger, who said that Davis's bill did nothing. And so just because they're all in the Republican Party doesn't necessarily mean that they see eye to eye. And also, if you are out in, say, western or central North Carolina, and maybe you're not dealing with PFAS pollution as your number one concern, you're more likely to listen to the Chamber of Commerce than when you're down here in the southeast in New Hanover County, where people are banging on the door of your office, screaming at you, asking you to do something about it.
Yes. Now we're moving on to hear from some of the Senate candidates about PFAS. Up next, we have Michael Lee.
So a bill came through the legislature, I believe it was H-600, that had in it that you could not establish what are called narrative standards, standards that allow you to have PFAS standards before rulemaking. And so what we did was we took that out so you could establish narrative standards. DEQ could come in and set standards for PFAS and also 1,4-dioxane. And DEQ actually did that for 1,4-dioxane. They did not do it for PFAS and started to go through the rulemaking process. I don't think we want legislators establishing scientific regulations and guidelines. DEQ should be doing that. They've got the authority and the power to do that. And so that's the process that they're going through. Again, narrative standards they could do by virtue of saying what they want the standard to be, so long as they have scientifically specific evidence in order to do that, and then go through the rulemaking process, because rulemaking takes longer. Narrative standards can be established sooner.
So we should say this was a rather technical question about the complicated way in which the state makes and enforces regulations on pollutants, and we're still working on a fact check on Lee's pretty technical answer. But I will say, as a layperson, what he is saying seems to be accurate. He's talking about ways to expedite the bureaucracy around regulating chemicals. And that's also a complaint we heard at the federal level. I mean, we found out as a public about Gen X in 2017, and it took 5 or so years before we started getting meaningful regulation on just a handful of PFAS. And even those were for water utilities. That was for drinking water, which put the onus and the cost on the public, not on the chemical producers and polluters. So while we don't have time for it on this show, there is an important and complicated conversation to be had about how the government goes about identifying and regulating potentially dangerous chemicals. Anyway, food for thought. Moving on, we've got Katie Randall, who pushed back on Lee a little bit.
I disagree with Senator Lee a little bit here. I think that it's okay for legislature to make legislation about the environment if it is informed by the expert opinion and public safety. It's a public health and safety issue, and I would support legislation to speak to that right now.
So this is something we heard, especially in the months after the Gen X story broke here in Wilmington, again back in 2017. Where, yes, there's thousands of PFAS. Yes, the process of testing their effects on humans takes a long time. The rulemaking process takes a long time. People were saying, hey, why don't we just shut down at least this one chemical from this one company right now through an act of law and then worry about the rest later? So we have heard calls for that in the past. Moving on, here is David Hill on the issue of PFAS.
The amount of inaction that has occurred, I find indefensible. As a doctor, I have families who want to know, do I need a whole house water filter? Can I drink the water if my child is small for gestational age or has developmental delay? Is that because of the water we're drinking? Those are both associated with PFAS pollution, and that stuff never goes away. So locally, New Hanover County and Brunswick County have initiated some means, some measures to make sure that our water is filtered. It's made it better. It hasn't gotten it all out. But this legislature has had all this time to stop or limit discharges at the source. That has not happened. They've had time to limit PFAS in products. That has not happened.
So a couple things here. One, I think CFPA would say they've gotten most of the PFAS out. There are occasional breakthroughs, but they have really, really led the charge in terms of building the infrastructure. Not free, that does cost ratepayers, but CFPA has come very close to completely eliminating the levels of PFAS in the water by orders and orders of magnitude from when the story broke back in 2017. The other issue is how people get exposed to PFAS in general, and that is a way stickier wicket. I mean, I don't think the state legislators even have the power to fully grasp this problem because, yes, PFAS is being dumped in the water by chemors, but it's also in fast food packaging. It's in nonstick cookware. If you've ever used a Teflon pan or used a nonstick pan to cook eggs and you scratched it or you preheated it or you overheated it, yeah, you got PFAS in your system. It's coming from everywhere. The General Assembly can do its part, but getting PFAS out of the sort of ecosystem as a whole, that's like a global problem.
Now we're going to move on from a discussion of environmental issues in North Carolina to a different issue altogether, independent redistricting. Definitely a hot topic. It's been a hot topic since I was in high school, Ben.
Yeah, so we have heard calls for independent redistricting for a long, long time. We have the General Assembly creates the maps both for federal seats and for state seats. And there was a long history of allegations of gerrymandering against Democrats when they were in power. When Republicans took control of the House and Senate, they also created gerrymanders, including some illegal gerrymanders. And so at a certain point, I think people on both sides of the aisle and, of course, unaffiliated people would just like to see someone create maps that can last more than one election without being challenged in court, and in some cases going all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So one suggestion has been, for years, an independent body that could look like a lot of different things. It could be a university, it could be a panel commissioned by the General Assembly, but the idea that some neutral third party could come in and create maps that fit the requirements for gerrymandering, because you do have to do some gerrymandering. Maps have to have certain appropriate ratios of racial demographics. They have to kind of fit with the division of counties within the states. So you can't not do it, but you have to do it in a way that is racially equitable, and you have to do it in a way that is kind of balanced in a partisan way. You know, North Carolina is a fairly even match between unaffiliated Republican and Democratic voters. But if you look at the congressional districts, they are wildly skewed. So that's the backstory. Here's David Hill on the issue of an independent commission to try and tackle this problem.
North Carolina is widely recognized as one of, if not the most gerrymandered state. We're a purple state. We're almost even. And yet, we have a Republican supermajority that no longer needs to even negotiate or talk with the minority party. They can override any veto they want. It's time for that to change, and that starts with redistricting.
Just a quick note, Hill is possibly referencing Newsweek, which did include North Carolina as one of the most gerrymandered states in the nation. It's kind of an ignominious top 10 list there.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, regardless, we'll move on now to our next Senate candidate, Catherine Randall, who was personally gerrymandered in her district.
If you look at the racial demographics of those neighborhoods, they're also the majority Black neighborhoods of Wilmington and New Hanover County. This perpetuates a really disturbing racial legacy in Wilmington of disenfranchising Black voters. Not just Wilmington, the whole South. We know this from our history. So we absolutely need an independent commission to be looking at that map and setting those boundaries. It should not be up to legislators to choose their voters. The voters should be choosing the legislators.
So Randall, of course, is challenging Bill Rabin, who did not show up to our forum, who represents Brunswick and Columbus County, but also an increasingly large swath of downtown Wilmington. It started out as what's called the Notch, which was kind of like the core of historic downtown Wilmington, and it's now grown to include all of what's known as the North Side and part of Central Wilmington, and that does include a lot of Democratic voters and a lot of Black neighborhoods. And so what Randall is saying here is that while it's not an absolute one-to-one, there are certainly Black voters who cast ballots for Republican candidates. Support for the Democratic Party has remained pretty strong. It's dropped a couple percentage points over the last couple presidential elections. So if you're moving them into a blood-red district, their votes are pretty much diluted. So that's the disenfranchisement she's talking about.
Moving on now, we'll go on to Michael Lee.
If we could get a truly independent commission, I think that is something that I could support. Some of the issues that we've had across our country, take California, Michigan, Colorado, and you can run down the list, and those folks that have created what they call independent commissions have found that there's an extreme amount of bias and they're truly not independent. You can take California, for example. The legislature that passed that independent commission ended up having more of the majority party after they passed it than before.
So Lee here is pointing to some concerns about transparency and impartiality that have cropped up for a lot of different independent redistricting commissions. I think the difficulty of finding a truly neutral third party, especially in our modern divisive environment, that's a real thing. That's going to be a real problem. But I also think democracy advocates, lowercase d democracy advocates, would say that that shouldn't be a reason to not find a way out of the state's long, ugly history of egregious and illegal gerrymandering.
Yes, I think it's interesting that he is kind of getting into a sense of decision paralysis almost over, oh, is there any neutral third party here? When this is something that we've talked about for 10 plus years, longer than that, when I was in middle school, actually, if I really think about it. Anyways, we'll move on to a Libertarian candidate, John Evans, who had an interesting third party approach to the whole situation.
In my opinion, the only reason they're complaining today is they've got the short end of the stick. Republicans, well, they have the upper hand now. And so they're throwing a little shade on the idea of changing the system as it is. I would be interested in a truly fair, impartial system. I just don't think that the powers that be would allow that to happen.
Evans, as our Libertarian candidate, came back several times to talk about the flaws inherent in a two-party system, or flaws as he sees it.
Yeah, as an unaffiliated voter, I have to say, he didn't sound totally crazy on those points. There is an intractable kind of vibe in Raleigh a lot of the times. All right, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about abortion and wrap up our show. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us.
We
Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here with my colleague Nikolai Mather as we round out our show about House and Senate candidates. This is from the forum we held with Port City Daily and WECT. And it's time to get to the topic of abortion.
It has been one of the meatier topics this year, especially with campaign ads, especially here in New Hanover County. The first person we're going to hear from on the topic of abortion is David Hill, who talked a little bit about his experience as a doctor.
That's right. And we asked Hill, along with all of the other candidates from the forum, whether they supported the current law, which bans abortions after the 12th week, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the health of the mother and fetal abnormalities, along with some other regulations on abortion providers, or whether they'd like to see stricter restrictions like those suggested by Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, the Republican candidate for governor right now, or whether they'd like to see the law rolled back to something less restrictive. So here's Hill.
In my opinion, the current ban endangers women's lives. Now, I want to give a little background on this. My opponent, Senator Lee, years ago told people in Wilmington that he would not support an extreme abortion ban. And in many people's minds, this is exactly an extreme abortion ban. But let me tell you a little bit more about my perspective on this. The thing that I do with the majority of my professional time is take care of newborn babies. So when this ban passed, my first response was to talk to the people that I work with. And what they told me is it is tying their hands when they know that mothers' lives are in danger, but it might be too early for them to prove to a non-medical observer. So they're waiting to act in cases like sepsis and hemorrhage, where we know that we have to act early to get a good outcome because they are afraid of the outcomes of this law. I would like to see it rolled back.
So we'll hear from Michael Lee in just a moment, pushing back on a number of these points. But I want to say there are plenty of objections and criticisms of the abortion bill that Lee helped craft. We've heard some of those from the North Carolina Medical Society and the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. But I do think it would be dishonest to suggest that Michael Lee did a bait and switch, that he proposed one kind of abortion bill and then delivered something else. We have some reporting in the show notes that dig a little deeper into that issue, so I recommend people check that out.
Absolutely. We're moving on now to John Evans, who didn't really have much to say in the way of policy, but expressed some of his personal beliefs about abortion.
It's my personal opinion that life begins at conception, but it's my job to represent my voters, not just my point of view. Women deserve deference on this topic. On this topic, I'm in favor of compromise, concession, and a whole lot of listening, because I'm a guy. I don't fully understand this, but I'm sure of one thing. Women are not the problem here. It's the men. It's the men that are not stepping up and being honorable, trustworthy partners.
Moving on now, we'll talk a little bit about Michael Lee's response to criticisms from his opponent about his stance on abortion.
Before the last election in 2022, I wrote an op-ed on what I would port, and actually, you know, that's very similar to the law that we have now. We've affirmed a woman's right to choose in the first 3 months. If the pregnancy results from rape or incest, you have 5 months to have an abortion. And if there's a serious fetal anomaly, it's 6 months. But it's at any time for the life or health of the mother. You know, these aren't arbitrary rules that we just kind of went into a room and crafted. It was really after a deep consultation with medical professionals and folks on both sides of this issue, which kind of led to, you know, the crafting of the language. You know, some states have had a problem with their language, and I think they might have had a problem that Dr. Hill is even reciting, and that's why we had our language in our bill to be different. The medical emergency that affirms a right to an abortion after the time periods have expired is if there's an impairment of a major bodily function. That's the standard. And so if you're telling me a physician doesn't know if there's going to be an impairment of a major bodily function of a woman such that they would feel comfortable performing the procedure, we crafted this language speaking with OBs and maternal fetal specialists to give them the room they needed to do what they needed to do in those instances.
So again, Lee has been pretty outspoken in his defense of the language that ended up going into this abortion law, including its protections for situations when the health of the mother is at risk, where there's fetal anomalies, or when it's an abortion in a case involving rape or incest. Obviously, we still hear plenty of criticisms about the bill, the uncertainty the bill has created, and the fact that the bill could be, as some people have suggested, a Trojan horse for future abortion restrictions. Lee has said he has no intention of crafting further abortion restrictions, but honestly, that's not something that everyone in the electorate trusts. So yeah, it's a really complicated issue, but for now, I think we got to move on.
I think we should move on. Up next, we have Catherine Randall, who stood out a little bit on this question, and she'll explain why.
To the best of my knowledge, I think I'm the only one up here that's given birth. Thank you. It was very difficult. I appreciate the applause. And so not only would I not support a more extreme ban, but I am in favor of changing it back to what it was for 50 years in our state, which is to the point of viability, which is around 20 weeks. You know, the vast majority of abortions do take place in the first 12 weeks, about 93%. But I have talked to women who have, you know, abortions, sometimes it's hard to get an appointment. They're expensive. The more we close abortion providers, the worse that problem gets. And sometimes women aren't able to get, even though they want one, and even though they want an appointment, they are raising the money to get an abortion, and sometimes that pushes them past that 12 weeks. We need that second trimester window to make sure that these women are able to raise the funds and get the appointment for the abortion care that they deserve. My pregnancy was difficult. I can't imagine making anyone go through that against their will. And to a point I made earlier, you know, about the minimum wage, about 3/4 of women who get an abortion when they were surveyed about their reasons for getting an abortion said they could not afford a baby. About half of people who seek abortions are already in poverty. Making sure that we have living wages in North Carolina, raising that minimum wage, is a public health issue that speaks to the abortion issue as well.
So we're still working on a fact check for the numbers that she just quoted to you. Half of people who speak abortions are already in poverty. 3/4 of women who were surveyed about their reasons for getting an abortion said they couldn't afford a baby. But what I will say is what Randall is describing here is extremely consistent with what is going on in the border belt of North Carolina, which is part of her district. Columbus County historically has really struggled to provide not only general gynecological treatment to women, but generally pregnancy care to women. And that includes abortion. And it should be worth noting that Columbus County is definitely the poorest county out of all 4 counties in the Cape Fear region. So Randall gets into her reasons for defending abortion in her district and in North Carolina, broadly speaking. Up next, we also asked this question of the House candidates. We have Ted Davis first, who talked about his vote in the abortion bill they've been discussing.
2 years ago, when we had this forum, I was asked as a standalone question, would I support the 20-week abortion limit that was presently the law? And I said that I would, and I meant it. When that bill came on the House floor, it was not a standalone bill. It was just not the issue of whether or not it was going to be 20 weeks or whatever. It was coupled with other things that affected women. The Speaker came to me on 2 different occasions telling me he wanted me to vote for that bill. I would not do that. I told him I would not do that because I had said in this very type of forum that we had tonight that I would support the 20 weeks. So when that issue came on for a vote on the floor, I did not vote for it. And I did not vote against it. And the reason I did not vote against it, because there were 2 things in that bill that nobody talks about that are so important. One of them is a Democrat-supported procedure whereby a child born for an unsuccessful abortion was allowed to be put into a room, no medical treatment whatsoever, and allowed to die. I can't do that. Another thing that was in there is that prior to that legislation being passed, Planned Parenthood, and other abortion clinics had no oversight whatsoever. That bill put in there the fact that, yes, Planned Parenthood would have oversight. It would be subject to inspections, and it would be guaranteed to be a safe place for women to go and have their abortions. Now, when the bill came up as a result of Governor Cooper's veto, yes, I voted not to override that veto, just like I have voted not to override the other 25 vetoes that Governor Cooper has had in our legislative session this time.
So there are a couple things that we're still working on fact-checking there, but I wanted to point out one in particular. Something he describes is how Planned Parenthood and other abortion clinics had, quote, no oversight whatsoever. It's unclear whether he's referring to state oversight or federal oversight or personal company oversight, But what I can say as a reporter is Planned Parenthood definitely has oversight from several different organizations, including the organization itself. Now, those who object to abortion might say that that's not enough, or that the state also needs to perform some inspections of these clinics. But we've also heard from abortion advocates across the United States saying that many of these inspections of abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood specifically are unnecessarily onerous. They block doctors from actually being able to do their jobs or being able to perform abortions. They introduce unnecessary regulations on things like hallway width or different equipment or other things that people can use to perform abortions. What did you think of it, Ben?
Okay, yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. First, this is not the first time Davis has suggested that there is routinely children being born after, as he called it, unsuccessful abortions and being left to die in a room. Davis has made this claim before, including during an interview on Coastline here at WHQR, where he claimed he had seen his Democratic colleagues in the General Assembly celebrating the defeat of a bill that would have banned this. And in general, this is something I've heard a lot from pro-life advocates. Some of this goes back to a 2019 controversy with Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. This is a complicated issue. We don't have time to unpack the entire thing on this show, but I will say briefly, we've spoken to plenty of doctors who say this is an incredibly rare situation where a child does survive an abortion procedure. Doctors do have an ethical obligation to then treat the child. In many cases, that child had a fatal abnormality, which was the reason for the later term abortion. And in that case, palliative care, really making the child comfortable, is all a doctor can do. But that is not the same as just putting the child like in a storeroom and leaving it to die. And for what it's worth, I'll add that we spoke to some of the Democratic members of the General Assembly that I think Davis was alluding to when he's brought this up in the past, and they said they would never celebrate a situation like this, which would be traumatic and tragic for the mother and the family. The second thing is Davis's actual explanation of what happened with the vote. He was under enormous pressure, having said that he wouldn't support a change in the abortion law, to vote for this bill. The GOP really put the screws to him, and he was more or less a swing vote because the margin at that time was pretty thin for the GOP to get that law passed. Now, he misspoke at the end. He said that he voted not to override that veto. He meant he voted to override that veto. And in maybe more slightly more articulate moments, what Davis has said was that he abstained from the initial vote on the bill. He didn't vote for it. He didn't vote against it. He's told us and other reporters that this allowed him to honor what he said in our 2022 forum, that he wouldn't support a change to the abortion law, but also not basically vote against his own party. But when it came, so the law passed without Davis's help, and Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, vetoed it. Then it came time for the GOP to try to override Cooper's veto. And what Davis has said in the past was that this was his way of checking the governor's power. He claims it has nothing to do with the substance of the bill, which included a lot of abortion-related legislation. Now, whether or not people go for that explanation is up to them.
Absolutely. Now we're moving on to Berger, who also talked about abortion and had a much less nuanced and much shorter answer in response to whether or not he supports the bill.
If elected, I would absolutely repeal the law that we have right now that's on the books. We've heard from the previous panel that said that it's dangerous to women, and I've talked with lots of doctors, nurses, maternal care people who have told me that.
Short and sweet, and that actually wraps up our discussion of the forum. Nikolai Mather, thank you so much for being here.
Ben, thank you for having me.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to WECT and Port City Daily for joining us for another year of candidates forums, and to the candidates themselves who joined us. A special thanks to John Evans from WECT for emceeing, and Cape Fear Community College for once again providing a wonderful space to hold these important civic events. Thanks as well to my WHQR colleagues, Nikolai Mather for co-hosting, Kelly Kinoyer for some invaluable production and editing assistance, and Ken Campbell, our one-man technical support army. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. If you have comments, questions, or an idea for a future show, let us know at newsroom@whqr.org. Early voting is underway and continues through the afternoon of Saturday, November 2nd, and Election Day is Tuesday, November 5th. You can find voting information, details on the new voter ID law, and lots more on candidates from races all around the Cape Fear region, all of that at whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.